On this podcast, you'll find interviews with high-performing, successful individuals in life sciences. On a weekly basis, we cover their proven methods, principles, strategies, and mindsets to implement new technologies that scale to meet the needs of people in our world.
Welcome to the Life Science Success Podcast. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Don, and I'm a consultant in life sciences. And I help companies overall streamline their broken processes and take out inefficiencies that really help to focus the companies and make them more profitable. So with that, let me welcome our guest today. Our guest is Rahul Kakkar. Rahul is a distinguished biotech executive and physician scientist, and I'm very excited to talk with him today about his journey as well as Tome Biosciences. So thanks a lot for being here.
Don, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And would you just mind taking a moment and sharing with the audience just a little bit about yourself and, you know, sort of your, I kind of call this like the journey to Spider-Man, right? So it's kind of like, what is it that led you to biosciences? But then secondly, what is it that really sort of bit you and made you want to be an entrepreneur in life sciences as well?
Yeah, I think my path here was very circuitous. You and I were talking before this about somewhat atypical career paths. I think mine definitely follows that. This really all started with medicine for me. So I trained, went to Tufts Medical School here in the Boston area, and then actually took some time off to do some science out in Chicago in the lab of Elizabeth McNally, who was a cardiovascular researcher. And I just got bit by the research bug, came back to Boston to train in the Harvard Hospital System, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Mass General in general medicine and cardiovascular disease, and did a second stint in the lab. And towards the end of that training period, something just didn't feel right. I mean, I loved my PI, Rich Lee. He was phenomenal. But I remember, you know, he kept on having me chase signals in a dish, and all I wanted to do was make drugs. And there wasn't a path to do that in academia. So I was all set to write grants and stay on at MGH as faculty when I had sort of this epiphany. You could call it epiphany or a panic attack. I'm not sure what it was. And effectively, you know, finished my fellowship without much of a plan, but said, I'm more interested in helping make the tools that improve lives than seeing patients, you know, one by one for the rest of my career. I remember my parents being like, you were offered a job at MGH and you said no. But it was really this curiosity, to not just be someone who could treat patients, but really understood how the tools that further patient care come to be. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate because I really was somewhat lost coming out of fellowship. I was still practicing medicine, so I wanted to hang on to that part of my career, but really didn't know what I wanted to do other than I was very curious about how drugs are made, how they're developed, how they're eventually commercialized. And as was the theme to most of my career, there was a gentleman at AstraZeneca who took a bet on me. And my entire career, because it's been so circuitous, has been, you know, fortuitous periods when people I now call mentors took a bet on me at certain times in my life.
I love the connection because I feel like networks and are the people that are in our networks really are multipliers for us as well, right? I mean, they're people that can watch out for us. They're people that can help guide us. They're people that can, you know, also educate us in terms of, you know, hey, have you ever considered this whenever you haven't? So I definitely think that you know, that those additions in our just connection to each other, you know, really help us as well.
I've had individuals who have been quite supportive, and I have had individuals who've been less than supportive of me in my career, and I've learned something from every one of them. I think it's been very interesting. I think your point about networks, we always talk about, you know, like you said, multipliers or people who mentor us or further our career. I've learned just as much from people who gave me some pretty tough feedback and were not supportive along the way as well. I guess it's just how you see it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then you mentioned AstraZeneca a second ago. You were in the innovations unit at AstraZeneca. Did that help to spark your interest in terms of where you wound up as well in entrepreneurship, or did it, you know, I guess just did it help to land you where you currently are?
100% in a way that is probably obvious, in a way that's less than obvious, kind of paralleling the conversation we just had. I was hired by a gentleman who I like to say saved me from academia, Don Frail, who's building this new unit at AstraZeneca, which was a drug repurposing unit, which, you know, specifically means taking molecules within the portfolio that may be designed for a certain disease indication and thinking about other uses outside of the vertical in which they're being developed. And so I joined, not that I ever thought I would go to big pharma by any means, but because it seemed like an incredibly fertile intellectual kind of playground to have a certain budget as a group and really have access to the entire AstraZeneca portfolio. And I think that idea of really finding the best use case for an asset or a technology where it can do the most good in human medicine, I guess you would call that entrepreneurial, but I think that's the sort of obvious use case, I think, or the obvious way I was pushed in that direction. And fundamentally, the first company, Corvidia Therapeutics, came out of that thought process. But I'll also say that some of the political complexity of a very large organization, you know, colloquially called red tape, but it really is, you know, politics, pure and simple, power dynamics, you know, personalities you have to deal with, entrenched culture you have to deal with, also sparked, I guess, what you would call an entrepreneurial bent, because I hated it. I hated all of it. And fundamentally, it was getting in the way of developing a molecule in a direction that I was very passionate about, which became Corvidia Therapeutics. I think had there not been those headwinds within AstraZeneca, Corvidia probably never would have happened. And maybe that's, again, an example of where a negative can be turned to a positive.
Yeah, and I mean, after having been with several large companies myself, I mean, I'm very familiar sort of with the politics end of it. And I guess the one question I would have with you then is in your entrepreneurial journey, right? So you're building companies yourself. You know, do you ever watch out for those same sort of signals that, hey, look, you know, hang on, it feels a little bit too much like we're building this thing that essentially is going to be a very top-down organization, or one that, you know, has too much bureaucracy in it, which is, you know, frankly, you know, normally what you tie to, you know, a lot of these larger corporations. Do you ever see that in the things that you've built, and then just say, you know, hey, look, I think it's time for a culture adjustment or a real opportunity for the organization to have another look?
So, yes, absolutely. I think there's two things that I learned from that aspect of my experience at AstraZeneca. One was how calcifying those sort of, you know, hierarchical, politically driven cultures can be, but also how enabling a champion can be. Because fundamentally, to start Corvidia, we had to out-license an asset, their IL-6 compound. And that was championed by Pascal Soria, the CEO of AstraZeneca. He and I got to know each other when I was managing the Moderna collaboration at the time. He liked the science we were pursuing within Don Frail's group. I knew that he liked the asset and the target, but he also understood that there were certain entrenched strategies and cultures within the cardiovascular group at the time that were going to make it almost impossible to pursue something that was as high risk, high reward as what we were proposing. And so he fully championed our out-licensing the compound and moving it into what became Corvidia. So I think I learned sort of those two aspects from my experience there. In terms of the companies I've been part of ever since, I was not CEO of Corvidia. The culture there was very, very different. It was a small organization. It was what we would now call virtual in many ways. This is, you know, many years pre-pandemic. Now what we would call a hybrid sort of organization is really what it was before that was a thing, I guess. But even at Pandion Therapeutics, I was not the first CEO of that organization. There was somewhat of a culture when I walked in. I think I've taken the learnings from AstraZeneca, from Corvidia, from Pandion into Tome, where I've been really from the very beginning to think proactively about the culture of the organization. I think SOP is a four-letter word. We kind of try to keep things very flat and very open. And I'll say that mostly to the credit of my team, when I sit down once a month with all the new hires that come into Tome, as I do, to welcome them and hear a little bit about why they've come to the organization, I hear two things. I hear the technology is amazing, and I hear the culture at Tome feels different than any other organization that I interviewed at. And that's been intentional. It's a source of pride. And I think if we are ultimately successful, it won't just be because of the science that we do, but also how we do it.
Yeah, there are so many things that you just said in that statement that are so important. I mean, one, having the CEO at AstraZeneca really understand, you know, hey, look, here's the limitations of the organization. I need to step in and help sort of, you know, help steer and guide and then push things along at certain points are very important. And then carrying those moments along as well in our career in terms of, you know, those elements of other organizations that we've been a part of. And hey, look, I like this bit and this bit. I'm going to add that together and sort of, you know, make my new path. And it really sounds like the culture that you're building, you know, over at Tome, you know, is one that, you know, you can really be proud of as well. The next question I have for you asks a little bit, you know, is more oriented around both your being a physician as well as, you know, a leader. So, I mean, in terms of your, you know, medical practice and things like that, how do you find like the balance between the two? How do you find that sort of capability to balance both?
So basically I'm blessed by having a very supportive team on both ends. I've got a cardiovascular division at the Brigham, which sees value in having what I like to call a black sheep in their midst, someone who's primarily in industry, a chief of the division who successive chiefs of the division, actually, as there's been some turnover in leadership over the 6 years that I've been there, who've always been supportive of my working there. I do about a month out of the year, a week at a time on the inpatient cardiovascular service at the Brigham. And I've always had, from AstraZeneca, from Don Frail to the board at Pandion, to the board at Tome, you know, a board of directors has been very, very supportive of my continuing to practice medicine. So it's not always easy. I remember when we were in the freneticism of discussions with Merck prior to their acquisition of Pandion, some of those final discussions between myself and the head of corporate development happened while I was in the hallway at the Brigham in my scrubs. So sometimes there's not as much of a bright line as I'd like. But honestly, I remember that Sunday when we were hammering out the final terms of the acquisition. It was one of the most frenetic, but also one of the most enjoyable days of my career. So I have people around me that for some reason are crazy enough to let me do what I do.
and the personality to be able to internalize a portion of this as well that you're not taking credit for. I can hear that, you know, also.
I will say that there's an incredible synergy between, it may not seem like it at first, but there's incredible synergy between what I do in biotech and what I do in the clinic, even though right now at Tome, we're not yet starting on cardiovascular disease. And so, you know, the clinical practice is a bit removed from the kind of clinical indications we're going after at Tome. But to be reminded of what patients and their families go through, I was on clinical service last week, and everything from having, you know, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister may not make it through this, and have them do well and go home, and the gratification there, and helping a family get through those conversations. But another family I took care of last week where their grandmother actually passed away while I was on service, but did so with the help of palliative care and our support services in the hospital. And the family, you know, this is a very elderly woman, and the family was there at the bedside when she passed. You know, helping families through those discussions, what's a treatment path? What could the side effects be? Helping them through those decisions. I feel like when I come back into the company and I'm surrounded by, you know, basic preclinical science, cap tables, Excel spreadsheets, it just keeps it real. And so going in once a quarter, spending a week taking care of patients, is mentally and emotionally exhausting, but rejuvenating at the same time.
Yeah, so it's so important. And I often ask people who were physicians and now are, you know, CEOs of drug companies or device companies, right? So they've made that true separation from patients. You know, do you ever wish that you could go backwards? And oftentimes they say no, because they feel like they could touch many more people with the drug or device that they're developing. But I mean, on your side, you're continuing that, right? And so it makes it, you know, probably it's very tough balance for you, but at the same time, very, very connecting as well in terms of the work that you do.
It is. I shouldn't underplay. It's not just support of my board and the chief of the division. It's also support of my family. You know, my kids mm-hmm. don't see me for that week. I work through the weekend. So I have to give a shout out to my three daughters as well for supporting me as I do the work. But I think that, you know, we have a gentleman here we hired as our head of clinical strategy, who was thinking about going back to practice again. And I told him, absolutely, you should do it. And we fully support him. He actually now practices again. And I'm very proud of him for doing that. When I was in my late 30s and I was just entering biotech, I said, well, when I hit 40, if my biotech career is doing well, maybe I'll drop the medicine. And here I am a decade later. And I can't imagine ever doing it any other way, but it does take a lot of patience and understanding from many people around me. So I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about TOME and what it is that you're focusing in on, and where do you currently stand?
So, you know, just to back up, the company was started in the summer of 2021, sort of in the first quarter of 2021. I came in towards the end of the summer of 2021 before our first fundraise came together. I had never worked in gene and cell therapy before. You know, first company was cardiovascular. The second one was autoimmune. Both were biologics-based companies. And in the summer of 2021, after the acquisition of Pandion by Merck, I think I went under CDA with somewhere between 18 to 19 companies. There was a lot of different companies that were I was being presented with, you know, people in my network, recruiters, venture firms that I had formed relationships with. And I wasn't seriously looking at, you know, cell and gene therapies, because I'm, you know, my history is really someone who's worked in and developed drugs in larger diseases. And by and large, gene editing companies have been rare disease companies, not to downplay the incredible importance and the incredible amount of burden that those diseases impose on families and the importance of those diseases. It just hasn't been a place where I've really focused my career. But when I read the foundational paper out of MIT, which formed the basis of TOME, there was that moment of how could I possibly do anything else with my career from here? Because the technology wasn't just, you know, a cool piece of tech. It suggested a path forward to bring genome editing to a very mature drug development pipeline or platform, I should say. When I think about our industry writ large, I think of three horizons. I think about the advent of synthetic chemistry, late 1800s into the majority of the 20th century, forming the backbone of many of the large pharmaceutical companies we know of today, and right underlie the pills that, at least at my age, I certainly take. You know, then we had the advent of biologics, recombinant proteins, fully human antibody therapeutics, gave rise to companies like Genentech, Amgen, MedImmune, you know, eventually acquired by AstraZeneca, Regeneron. And I think we're in sort of the heyday of the third horizon, which is really nucleotide-based therapeutics, whether it's, you know, Moderna's and BioNTech's vaccines, or whether it's siRNAs from Alnylam or ASOs from Ionis. But I think the next horizon will be DNA editing. But I would submit that of all of the editing technologies that have come so far, and I would go back even to gene therapy as we know it today, those technologies still have some fundamental technical limitations which prevent them to be as industry defining as some of the names I've just mentioned, right? The Alnylams of the world, the Modernas of the world, the Regenerons of the world. And when I read the paper that underlies Tome, I stepped back and said, this solves effectively all of the technical limitations we have except for delivery. And this is not a delivery company, we're a DNA editing company. And so for me, it was, how could I not jump back into being an operator and bring everything to your point, everything that I've learned about culture and how to bring out the best in people, ideas and philosophies that people use with me to bring the best out of me, bring that with cutting edge technology to really create an industry defining company. Because when you're dealing with a technology that is ostensibly going to create some of the most complex drug products our industry has ever envisioned, I mean, this is genetic surgery. This is the equivalent of landing something on another planet. You need complex organization, multiple different teams with multiple different expertise, with different cultures of their own, because they come from different backgrounds, all working in a way that's harmonious. We're not going to do this developing drugs in a traditional way or with traditional cultures.
So I'm going to be a bit naive here and explain a little bit of the, my own journey in life sciences. So whenever I came into life sciences, so I certainly knew what small molecules were whenever I came in. One of the people that I worked with at the time was so excited by monoclonal antibodies. He just, I mean, every place he went, he was just like, this is going to be the next breakthrough. This is going to be tremendous in our industry. You know, we love it. And, this is going to be tremendous. You know, we went, I don't know, a full decade, I want to say, before all of a sudden there was even a hint of, some of the things that you just alluded to, right? I mean, and, Regeneron, I feel like, is a great example there, right? I mean, they've done, a great thing with their magic mice and their capabilities in terms of developing, foundational drugs that you wouldn't have without some of this stuff. And yet, I kind of look at this next horizon going, there's probably going to be a level of, sort of directness, but then there's also going to be a lot of course correction that eventually lands us to the point where it's like, okay, so not only did we bring this thing in, but it is tremendous as you described. So, I just kind of look forward to the journey because, as an outsider, not a biologist, from my standpoint, it's fun to actually see all of the amazing things that happen. So back to the one question as well, at Tome, what specifically are you working on? What are you looking to develop?
Yeah, just a comment on what you just said. I think you're spot on. It's not even just in biopharma. If you look at any human industry, the first iterations and the first examples of a new technology are very, very rarely the ones that actually define the asset class or the technology. It can take decades. And if you look at where we are in genome editing, when CRISPR was first discovered, we're getting to that decade mark. So I think, and there've been a lot of companies that have been formed along the way that are each going to have, some interesting drugs along the way for sure. But really a full embodiment of the potential, I think that's where we are now, a decade into CRISPR-based technologies, and that's what we're trying to do at Tome. So specifically, Tome is focused on this philosophy because there are a couple of different technologies we use to achieve this called programmable genomic integration. And what I mean by that, we didn't hire some fancy PR firm to help us come up with that language. That was really our scientists stepping back and saying, what is it that we do? And what we do, frankly, is we have the capability using a couple of different protein architectures to achieve this, which is what I mean by a couple of different technologies, to place pieces of DNA into the genome, integrate them into the genome in a programmable manner, which means a scientist or a drug developer can look at a genome and say, I need to put X piece of DNA into Y location precisely, and they can do exactly that. And that really has not been possible until the base technology invention out of MIT, which formed the foundation of this company. And then we augmented that with our acquisition of Replace Therapeutics most recently. But all of it centers on this idea of using CRISPR-Cas9 with a augmenting protein to find an area of the genome where we want to edit, repair, change in some way, and then be able to do that without any limitation to size or efficiency. And it really now brings DNA editing to a mature drug development a methodology.
So important as well. I mean, I can think of all of the, you know, just the potential future, right? And, you know, it could open some amazing doors as well in terms of, you know, the impact that it could have on mankind and is frankly, you know, all sorts of, you know, other opportunities as well.
Sometimes I feel like we get very caught up in the technologies. And this comes up a lot as I'm speaking to investors. There's been such an explosion of DNA editing technologies, even RNA editing technologies that are out there. It becomes a bit of an alphabet soup of all the different platforms. And I always step back, again, this is sort of where my clinical training comes in, is if the technology is not creating drugs that offer meaningful new therapies for patients, if they're all leading us to the same sets of diseases or to diseases that you can adequately control with other methodologies like pills, like injectables, like, you know, like small molecules, like biologics, then it's interesting technology, but it's not really novel drug development. It has to lead to novel drugs that create new paradigms of therapeutic effect, fill a true unmet need. And I think, you know, as we sat back and thought about where to apply our technology, although we haven't publicly disclosed our pipeline as of yet, that will come later this year as we start talking about our data. What I've been most excited by is the fact that the diseases we're going after are those that are either completely unserved by any current modality or are drastically underserved. And that's what, to me, again, being a clinician first and a recovering scientist, since I never hacked it as an academic, really gives me confidence that our technology truly is different because it's underlying, you know, drug development programs that are truly differentiated.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next few questions, I specifically would like to talk about you. Just in terms of all of your accomplishments in your career, is there a specific project or accomplishment that you would go back to and say, hey, I'm most proud of this in my life and why?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is actually an individual here at Tome. It's an individual who I have worked with now across a couple of companies, who I hired into one of my prior companies. And I have had the distinct privilege of seeing this individual grow from having a very narrow remit in the company from which I hired them to being an absolute powerhouse of a drug developer now across two companies where this individual's scope has just grown over time. And so it's not any one individual drug. I mean, I could certainly talk about the drug at Corvidia and how it's now in phase three. And if it reads out positive in a couple of years, it will save hundreds of thousands of lives. And of course I would be proud of that. That's right. That's the dream come true for a physician, scientist, drug developer. But interesting, the first thing that came to mind when you asked me that question was this individual and how I've seen this person's capability, effectiveness, the way this person inspires the people around them, really grow over time, and to have been part of that person's journey now over half a decade, I think has been one of the things I'm most proud of. And I would hope that some of the people like Don, like Michael Davidson, like Pascal Sorio, and Alan Crane, Dan Lynch, people who stepped into my career at pivotal times and helped guide me in a certain way, feel the same sense of pride in me. Mm-hmm. That's kind of pride I feel in this individual who hopefully I've helped steer in the right direction a long time, because they're an incredible drug developer.
Yeah, I feel like great leaders that do this well, they pull together these pieces of, you know, and I oftentimes use the analogy of a runway, right? So they create the runway when it's needed. They clear the runway when it's needed. They light the runway when it's needed. They sort of repave, you know, you could just like reuse that same analogy over and over again. And I just, you know, sort of envision that, right? As you're talking about this half a decade that you've been together with this individual that, you know, hey, look, they just needed realistically the right runway. And then the right leader to sort of, you know, help to guide that as well. You know,
I don't know why the image that came to mind was Bruce Willis at the end of Die Hard. you know the scene.
Yeah, no runway lights and exactly. Running around lighting candles or something. I don't remember specifically, but I do remember the scene. So what's the greatest piece of leadership advice that you've ever received?
Two things come to mind. One is one of my mentors, I might get this wrong, at the bottom of their email says, things turn out the best for those who make the best of the way things turn out. Mm. This is biology. You never know how it's going to go. These are you know, complex organizations with individuals with each with their own uniqueness. You never know, you know, how things are going to turn out. But believing in what you're doing, but also believing enough in what you're doing to know when something's not working and pivoting. I think, you know, making the best of the data in front of you, I think has been, I wouldn't say it's leadership advice. It's really, you know, again, it's at the bottom of this individual, Michael Davidson, one of my mentors, it's the bottom of his email, but it's also the philosophy in which he lives. And I've just sort of tried to model that. That's one thing that comes to mind. I think, you know, really having, and what that leads to, that philosophy leads to is, and this is something I learned from my time at Corvidia as well, where he was the CEO when I was the chief medical officer and we worked very closely together, is that lends you to have a very steady hand when things go sideways. Mm-hmm. And I think some of this also comes from my medical training. When you're in inpatient cardiology, there are plenty of times where there are emergencies and when the amygdala fires and the sympathetic nervous system shoots up and you're flooded with adrenaline, how to keep a steady hand on the tiller through that, whether in the hospital or you're in a company. I think that's one piece. I think the other piece, honestly, which is less advice, is just something I've learned along the way is, you know, leadership advice, leadership books, coaching, all of that. I hate to say it, but I've never found a lot of that very useful. I think the most useful self-advice perhaps is be who you are. Don't try to adopt a persona because people don't follow personas, people follow people. So being as genuine as possible, oftentimes that requires a lot of emotional bravery with yourself and with the people around you. I think between having a steady hand and never trying to be false with people, never trying to have a persona, never have a try to have, you know, an ethos, but just really being a genuine person. If I had to say I've ever had to rest on anything as first principles, it would be those two.
The reason why I smiled towards the end is that this sort of idea of having like an alternate personality, anybody that's watched this show for any period of time kind of sees me stumble and flub over things and, you know, believe me, I would much rather none of that stuff ever show. But at the same time, that is who I am. And anybody that's been around me long enough has seen me, you know, trip and stumble along the way, especially with my tongue. So I had to, you know, make it personal for me as well. So thank you for sharing that.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
What inspires you?
The human spirit to never give up. I see it in so many places. I see it in, you know, the challenges my kids. I've got two teenagers, one younger one who's, you know, always happy, you know, rainbows and unicorns, and she's great. But the older two are teenagers. It's tough being a teenager these days. But they, you know, they excel and persevere through all of these challenges that they have to go through that are far more complex than anything I had to go through. When I see, again, you know, patients and their families, kind of what we're talking about before, I'm hesitating to say never giving up, but they have the spirit to do right by the people and the ideas that care about, but also know when to move on. Mm. And that, I think that's also part of the human spirit. And sometimes never giving up is knowing when to let go. But that human spirit that constantly drives us to continue moving forward, whether we're caring for a loved one, whether we're dealing with something at work or at school, but always having that North Star that we're always driving towards, that human spirit, I think that's what inspires me most of all. And I try to live up to that idea of no matter how hard things get, no matter how many challenges are in our way, emotions are temporary, challenges are temporary, there is a North Star, and the human spirit to always drive towards that North Star that goes back, you know, to our species from the very beginning. When I see that, you know, when I see that in hospital, when I see it in my kids, when I see it in the scientists here who are dealing with some very complex problems, that's what inspires me most.
Thank you for sharing that. What concerns you?
I think that we are coming to an era of incredibly complex medicines that can have profound effects on how we live our lives. I mean, some of the cell therapies that we see others pursuing, that we're pursuing as well, the gene therapies that we're developing, we're using the word cure. And that is not a term that I used when I trained in medicine back at the end of the aughts and into the early 2010s. It's not a word we used even when I entered AstraZeneca in 2011. But it's a word that we use routinely here at Tome, because everything we do is going after, if not durable disease control, outright cure. And I think what concerns me the most is we do not have a healthcare system that understands how to manage that. It's a completely different paradigm of commercialization, payment and reimbursement, how to introduce those concepts to patients, the risk reward and doctors, PBMs and insurance companies. We have an incredibly complex, but in many ways, legacy healthcare system in the US and across the world, unless you are a nascent country building it from the ground up, like they have in the Middle East, for instance. And I think what concerns me is that, and I had this direct conversation with an investor recently, the science is in many ways moving faster than the systems that would support them. And I don't think we're going to fumble through that as a society. And I think that concerns me, because I think there are some medicines and therefore patients that might get left behind along the way.
Yeah. I think to the last part of your statement, right. The timing. So one of the things that I said many times on this show was that I was really hopeful watching the timing of the vaccine for COVID that, hey, look, we now could potentially have a different, a more accelerated, altered timeline, because maybe through this pandemic, we would have learned something, you know, that then could be carried forward. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I don't do a lot on the drug approval side. I'm not exactly sure that lesson was learned, but because as an outsider, again, it appears that, you know, a lot of what was there still exists, and that, you know, more or less, we still have a lot of the same issues. The advantages, right, I could clearly see being, you know, that, hey, maybe more people get benefited by the drugs that are coming out, to not use your cured analogy again. But the, you know, the other opportunity really is, you know, hey, you know, maybe we through this could then find some of the things that cause us to falter faster as well, right? So, I mean, you know, I know that the science of testing and providing safety and things like that is not something that I would, you know, definitely want to see anybody, forego. But at the same time, you know, maybe given some of the new technologies that we have and things like that, there is a reason to go back and look at the way that we currently approve things. I don't know. It's just a sideliner's philosophy here on the podcast. But anyway. So last question, what excites you?
I think, you know, very much along the lines of what we were just talking about, ushering in an era of medicine where we're truly allowing people to live not just better lives, because most of medicine to date, when you're talking about, again, as we go back before, small molecules, biologics, siRNAs, ASOs, they're all about disease control. They don't often extend life, but they do improve quality of life most of the time. And in cardiology, right, we're always talking about extending life in our outcome trials. But by and large, drugs that extend life are far less common than drugs which control disease so we can live better lives. And that's laudable. That's the basis of our industry so far. But I think with the ability to fundamentally, you know, recode cells, if they're broken out of the gate, as it were, from birth, and to fix that, you know, we talk here about curing children before they ever knew they were sick, or it's designing very advanced cell therapies that can truly suppress diseases in adults in larger populations to the point where effectively you could call it cured. We're entering an era where we are using biology not just to control disease, but to push it so far below the threshold of detection that we actually extend our lifespan. Mm-hmm. I think that moving into that era, I think is what excites me. And as I think about, you know, I thought about this as I was deciding whether to come to Tome or not. If the 20th century was really a period where we controlled infectious diseases, right? Cured infectious diseases, and created, you know, a panoply of drugs to control chronic disease, would the 21st century be the era in which we truly start curing those diseases? And to just be, for whatever time on earth that I am, a small cog in that machine that drives our species in that direction, can't think of a better thing to do with my life.
So exciting as well. Well, Dr. Rahul Kakkar, thank you so much for being on the Life Science Success podcast. I greatly appreciate you being here and for telling us all about Tome and the great things that you're working on. And yeah, I wish you all the success in the future. It's a great journey to get to hear about.
My humble thanks, Don. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Life Science Success. For complete details about this podcast, including show notes, how to get in touch with guests, and more episodes, please visit www.lifesciencesuccess.com. If there's someone you'd like for us to invite to the show as a guest, please let me know by sending me a message at the podcast website. Please click subscribe on your favorite podcast app, share the podcast, or tell a friend about it, and last but not least, rate the podcast. Thank you again.